The great philosopher Kierkegaard said, "Life can only be understood backwards, but it must be lived forwards." Looking back only results in learning for people who have that time to think. And many of us are so busy with day-to-day demands that we rarely have time to reflect. And that's why we started What I Wish I Knew. It's for those moments when you realize that just a bit of insight might have come in handy if you had it in advance. I'm Mike Irwin.
And I'm Simon Dorr. So we talk with people from all walks of life, from startup entrepreneurs to Fortune 500 CEOs, professional athletes to weekend warriors, from artists and to designers to even engineers who became designers, from those who dream to those who dream then actually do. They all have three things in common. None are perfect, all are humble, and each have truly incredible learnings. In What I Wish I Knew, they share these lessons with you.
Join us at whatiwishinewshow.com. Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you find your favorite podcasts. And please share and subscribe to What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Dorr.
Okay, so welcome everybody to this episode of What I Wish I Knew, and I'm absolutely delighted to welcome Nick Dorman. Nick is a specialist, and he's an amazing leader in what we can talk about shortly in a product design and managing big brands around the world. His background, which I'm sure you'll go into very shortly, Nick, but his background was actually in engineering, and then he slipstreamed from that and from that skill set into product design and into innovation. And he's also worked with some major brands around the world, which you will all know yourselves, such as Unilever and a Giffgaff. He hails from Surrey, close to London in the UK, which I'm sure he'll have some interesting stories and facts to share us along the way. So, Nick, I guess, you know, we always say start at the beginning, but I guess in some ways the question is, where would you like to start? You know, we asked you What I Wish I Knew. What and how would you capture that in a kind of essence here for us?
Well, I suppose in terms of starting, I think you mentioned my background, and I think that has relevance to one of the first things I wanted to kind of discuss. So, my father was a director in Barclays Bank. He moved around with various different jobs in the bank. So, you know, he spent some time out in Africa, but then mainly back in the UK. I was born in Surrey. We moved to Hampshire, moved out to Jersey. That's the Jersey in the Channel Islands, not in the US. And lived on an island for a while, and then came back and lived in Surrey. And so very much what we call a home counties upbringing. Very traditional. Loving parents, you know, I have a younger brother, and very, very happy childhood. And I think I look to my father, as many, many boys do, to who I should be when I grow up. I admired my father immensely, still do. He's still alive, thankfully. But he was in one of those big traditional industries, banking, you know, where you had a career mapped out for you from the day you joined. You know, you were looked after. You know, your whole family was looked after, really. And you followed a path. And that's what led my father around various different roles around the bank. And I thought that was what was going to happen to me. You know, that was going to be my, you know, I was going to join a company and they were going to look after me for the rest of my life. As so many, I think, young men of my age did, because most of my friends' fathers were in those sort of industries, or mothers for that matter. So, so that was my upbringing. I didn't know what on earth to do. I was academic, practical, but a bit lazy, I think, because I was lacked direction. So I ended up at a polytechnic rather than a university, which don't exist anymore. I studied an engineering product design. And the reason is that I studied that is because I thought the name sounded interesting. And nothing more than that. I thought that sounds quite cool. Whereas mechanical engineering, things like that, when I went off to university to see those ones, I thought, oh, I didn't like the people. I didn't like, you know, I was very fussy. I didn't really know what I wanted. So that's where the story starts, really. I moved to London, where my father harks from, actually, and I've ended up living in the same sort of area that a lot of my family used to live. None of them live here in London anymore, so I feel like I'm the only true Londoner left out of the family. I went to college and learned about engineering. And engineering product design at Southbank was actually extremely interesting. It was run by a guy called Bill Bond, who worked for St. Mary's Hospital. And he was basically, he was designing prosthetics and other machines for people. And what he found was mechanical engineers didn't really understand how to interface with people. They knew how to interface with other machines, but not with people. And so he started the course really to create engineers who could design things for people, which was totally unique. And I landed on my feet there because I was really fascinated by that whole world. However, I still didn't really know what that job would be. I didn't want to go and work in his hospital unit. And I didn't. I actually ended up working for in my year out in industry for a company that made a lot of military hardware. And in fact, I actually helped design a camera system for what's called the wheelbarrow, which was, if you're as old as I am, you'll know from the troubles in Northern Ireland, it was a device that diffused bombs. So it was very technical, understanding how to work with electric motors and gears and all sorts of things like that, construction stuff. But very, very classic engineering. And absolutely decided, oh, and I also designed a bit of a jet engine for the Tornado jet engine while I was there as well. So real classic engineering stuff. I absolutely decided I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to be designing the cast iron ring that fitted into a jet engine that was made of a gazillion different parts. I wanted to deal with the hull. When I came back from my year out in industry, I met all of my great pals, and he'd gone off to work for a company called Pentagram because his dad was actually in the design industry. And he was describing to me what life was like at Pentagram, a product design company. And I thought, oh my God, that exists. I didn't even know it existed. And so that's what I wanted to do. And that created the first change in my life. Now, I'll go into that in a minute, but that was a long setup. But that set me off on my path. I then wanted to leave and leave Polytechnic. And I wanted to be a product designer. And that was a big kind of point in my life where I had a big transition. And then I've gone through, as you said, I've been through several different career changes. And I think I can go into each one of those as I go along to get me where I am today.
That's fascinating. I guess then, and you know, we haven't talked about this before, but you kind of went into it with an open eye and an open view and an openness to do that course, like you said. But fairly quickly, you came away realizing, hey, this is not right. Yeah. I mean, is that a kind of part of you that says, hey, if things, even in that early part of your life and learning, that you're very quick to take a decision? I mean, you know, help us understand that.
I think it's, so in that respect, I think once you you go through life, I think most people don't know what they want to do half the time. But I think you have to have your eyes open for opportunities through your life. And I think that's one of the things that I realized actually was when I spoke to my mate Chris, who was in that product design world. I thought that sounds right for me. That sounds, because I didn't know what career I wanted, but I knew that I liked working with my hands. I liked creating things. You know, when I was a kid, I used to take everything apart and never quite be able to put it back together again. Did it with cars, did it with all sorts of things. So I kind of knew that that was the world I wanted to be in. But also that big picture for me, and that's going to come in later on, is that sometimes I love being in the detail. But I can't be in the detail forever. I'll get dulled by it. So I have to go, why? Why is it like that? And I step back. And when I heard about product design, I thought that's what product design was about. Product design was about creating things for people in their wholeness. But that was a big problem because I was an engineer. So I think I thought, how on earth am I going to become a product designer if I'm an engineer? Do I go off and spend another load of years studying, or do I try and get a job with a product design company? So I suppose that was the first big thing for me, was how do I shift? You know, as you say, I did sort of recognize I wanted to. I had a vision of where I wanted to go, and I had to shift. And I think what a first thing I kind of realized in my naivety, really, is that I had to have some sort of value for these people. So when I obviously I applied to lots of different product design companies that are out in around London, I got no's from everyone. And thought, well, they're not just going to employ me as a product designer when I've got a degree in engineering. So, but I did talk to people. I talked to lots of people. And what I realized is that all these companies had engineers in them. They needed to be able to engineer the designs that they were doing. And what I realized was that most engineers learn very classic engineering. So they learn about metal. And in product design, it is a world of plastic. And so if I could learn how to design plastic as well as I could design metal things very simplistically, I might have an opportunity there, because I'd have a skill set that was needed, something particular. So I then spent the summer in Surrey University learning all about plastic injection molding, everything I could learn from every book they had in there. And I redesigned my entire portfolio, which was very mechanical, into everything had plastic moldings in it. I just redid my portfolio over a summer, reapplied again to all those same companies and got interviews, and then got a job at a place called Moggridge Associates. A guy called Charles Ash hired me. He was a head of engineering there. It was only a very small company at the time, about 15 people maybe. And he needed a young engineer to come and join him and design products for him. So, you know, so that was it. My opportunity was there. So that, you know, they needed that. But I went in there and I was very cheeky. And I said, look, I'll come in as an engineer, but I really want to be a product designer. So will you train me to be a product designer? And they very, very kindly said, yeah, sure, no problem. We'll do that. And I hit upon a culture there. So this company is called Moggridge Associates at the time. And I'm going to talk maybe later about Bill Moggridge, who was one of my kind of heroes, I suppose. And it was, they were an eclectic bunch anyway. So I think I fitted in really rather well. But they did. I had an apprenticeship in product design. They let me design things as well as engineer them. And I was shocking at the beginning, but I learned fast. I was with some incredibly creative and talented people. I did a parallel sort of life. I developed engineering designs, and you know, I designed a Dankl telephone, which was in the Cooper Hewitt Museum. It was in the V&A. It was in the Design Museum, various different places. So a very difficult, complex piece of technical engineering. So, and I did all that, and then several years later on, I got the opportunity to redesign that same design, but I got the opportunity to do the product design as well as the engineering, which was an amazing opportunity. But just looping back, I went over and as part of that job, went over and worked for their San Francisco office called ID2, directly working with Bill Moggridge, who founded the company in London and then moved to San Francisco. So I was working over there, and I had lunch with him. And he said, Nick, it's time to make a decision. You cannot be both an engineer and a product designer. It's impossible. He said, you've got to choose one or the other. What are you going to do? And I was stubborn, and I actually said, no, I like doing both. I like doing both. That's what I want to do. And he was quite sort of insistent that I chose, and I was quite insistent that I didn't want to do that. I don't know where I got it from. I don't know why I was so stubborn. And at the time, to be honest, I found Bill quite disconcerting, because he was utterly different from what I expected a boss to be. Like I was saying before about my father went through this very traditional way. Well, Bill was a hippie. I mean, in his kind of way of thinking, wonderful man. But just totally different. And I didn't know what to make of him. And he seemed, and there never seemed to be any structure to anything, and he was trying all sorts of different things. And I will come back to him, remind me to come back to him. But so I think maybe I was being stubborn because I didn't quite know what to do with him, and he didn't know what to do with me either. But bless him, he said, okay, carry on. And I came back to London and I redesigned this dang old phone and got a British Design Award for it. So I proved to him, and it was a bit of a proving point, I have to say, that I could do both. But then I realized actually he was right after all that. Because it was too big a job. You couldn't do the engineering and the design. Your head couldn't cover off both things. I did it on there and it was exhausting. In some ways it was good because you could integrate the two very carefully, but it's more than one person's job. So I realized you had to subdivide out. And so I then dropped the engineering and I moved fully over towards a product design and spent 13 years at IDEO as it became. Mortgage Associates then joined with DKD, which is Day Kelly Design, down in Palo Alto, and became IDEO. And I spent 13 amazing years there, working on all sorts of incredible things, from navigation equipment to I helped start up digital radio for the BBC. It was so diverse. Post boxes, any post box you see in airports in the UK or railway stations are all designed by me. Lots of telephones, which are very embarrassing to look at now because they're so enormous, portable telephones that you need a truck to carry around in. Wonderful time.
Nick, how would you take that? You spoke about a number of things, Nick, and it's interesting. You come across as someone who's obviously very curious, and you talked about growing up, you took things apart and that kind of thing. But then also the notion of figuring out a path and figuring out what you wanted to do. I wondered, as an engineer, I guess my vision of the way engineers are trained are fairly precisely, and that there's a logic and there's a rubric for the way that things should happen. And yet with product design, it tends to be more, I would think, more intuitive or more, broader about the way that you assess things. So as you look at your career, do you feel like the elements of what make you a good product designer and a good engineer at the same time were evident pretty early on?
Yeah. Yes, I would say that there are those two sides of my character, for sure, because there's the bit of me which is a bit anal about detail. So you'll find me as a managing director now poring over spreadsheets and creating formulas and all sorts of things like that. And then there's a part of me which is stepping back from that and working with people. To be honest, the product design of it that I loved, I wouldn't say I was the best stylist in the world by any stretch of the imagination, but I was really always fascinated by people and the problems that people have and how products could solve those problems, and how you could connect those things together. And that's the biggest driver for me through everything, is that bigger thing. But there's times when I'm quite happy to just dive into that detail and get lost in it. But then I suddenly go, oh my God, I need to climb out again and see the big world. So I don't sit in one camp. I definitely kind of straddle both. But I think I suppose when you talk about product design, if it's a stylist where someone's just being very truly creative. My wife's a graphic designer, and her brain works very differently from mine. I don't have that same aesthetic ability. I would say I can design things that look good, but I think it's more about problem solving for me, which is, I suppose, is the engineer as much as anything. A good engineer is a problem solver as well as down in doing the detail drawings. So yeah, a bit of both.
Nick, you also gave us the impression earlier, a strong impression that you when you get onto something, you're quite steadfast. You talked about your experience in the US. How do you manage that in your leadership style? Because like you just alluded to, you may outside of you looking at the spreadsheet piece, but you may have a strong belief or a direction on something, and you're leading a big team. How do you manage that as a leader?
It's funny, that actually relates to what we sell into a lot of companies, because we actually offer what we call future visioning. And I'm a real advocate of knowing where you want to have a vision of where you want to go. But that's not a rigid thing. It's a kind of a direction. And the way I describe it to our clients is, it's like, they're all desperate to figure out what the next step is. You know, give us an innovation that's going to come out in 6 months. You know, it's going to change the world. And I always say to them, you will not know what to do next until you know where that's taking you. So if you start with where that's a step towards, then that step becomes a lot easier in terms of doing, but also deciding. And I think for me, my biggest criticism and an awful lot of innovation today is it's too short-sighted. It's too reactive. It's too embedded in today, not tomorrow. And true visionaries are able to, and I wouldn't say I was a brilliant visionary or anything, but are able to create a kind of an ambition and then start to move towards it. And I suppose that's what I did at the beginning. I wanted to be a product designer. I didn't know what that meant or how I was going to get there, but I wanted to do that. And I've tried every which way to do it. So as a leader, I suppose I always felt that Echo needed to have a direction. It needed to know where it was going. And I have to admit, there has been a few years where it didn't know where it was going. We were being led by the work we were winning more than anything else. So we were being led around. Doing the next, every job we won, we took us in a different direction. And this sort of brings us more towards today, is that what I realized was actually focusing our business on creating a more sustainable world is a real vision you can work towards. And it actually brings everyone together. Because if everyone shares that same belief structure, they can all carve very different paths towards it. As long as they're moving towards that path, we'll be a team. And it's true. Oh my God, it works. It's a really, really powerful and simple thing. If everybody, it's like a team out there wanting to win a match, they're all going towards that one thing of winning that match. It's a simple analogy. In business, it's not quite like that. You need to know, you know, need to have something a bit richer to work with. And, you know, what I realized was that designers created the world that we live in today, the throwaway consumable kind of today world that we live in. It was created by designers. We created the desire for the throwaway, you know, the white t-shirt, the plastic bag, or whatever it is, that we designed in convenience, we designed in lightweight, we designed in all those things. It was designers that did that, no one else. So I realized that actually designers were people that were responsible for turning that around and had the capability of doing it, because we did it in the first place, so we can undo it and we can do something better. And I think that simple story resonates with every designer I've ever spoken to. So that, you know, that pulls everyone together.
And that kind of powerful positioning of sustainability, I'm interested in two things. One, do you feel, because we all care, yeah, years ago we all cared, but do you feel that was in you years ago, but you kind of ignored it, or do you feel that it's come to prominence and it's absolutely a, like you described, a tenement that you take? And I guess ultimately, with that power and belief in sustainability and drive, which is meaningful, do you turn business away? Do you say, hey, this is not right?
So the first thing, I think I have to just rewind a little bit, if I may, because as I said, I spent a long time being a product designer. So I'm just going to segue off and then come back in to answer that question, if that's all right. When I was designing things for lots of kind of techie companies like Samsung and Toshiba and all those sort of companies, we were designing amazing products for them, which they were not doing a very good job of selling. because they didn't seem to understand how to communicate the values that we created in those products, which were useful things. They did, for me, back at that time, the word sustainability didn't exist, but I think everything I created, I felt, had a purpose and a use. So it had value and worth, and it was worthwhile doing. But I often felt that when it was being sold, I didn't know, I couldn't tell of any of those things that we, as all the design teams have put into those things, was not being communicated. You know, look at all the TVs out there. If you put your, I always do this thing, you put your finger over the Toshiba or the Sony brand mark. Do you know, tell me what that says to you. What values does that have? Who is it? No one knows. So that's why I then said, what is this thing about branding? Because that seems to be the thing out there that is really trying to deal with that. We're really trying to understand what the product is and what its values and benefits are, and how to communicate that to a consumer, to an end user and a buyer. And I want to learn how to do that. So I jumped ship, and I can come back to that if you like, but I jumped ship, and the only place I could jump ship and have value, and this is again an important, like coming back to that original thing, I realized I needed to have value. If I was going to learn something new, playing the old game again that I played originally, I had to have value for someone, and I'd learn as I went along. And my value at that time was innovation. I'd been running really big innovation projects for all sorts of different technology companies. And at that time in the consumer goods world, that was a kind of a new thing. People was just starting really to talk about it. So I got in as a head of innovation for consultancies. And as part of that, I was learning about branding. But the thing is, I moved into this world of consumer goods, and I hated it. The stuff, the rubbish that I was working with out there, I'm just thinking, I didn't like it at all. It didn't. You know, I liked my televisions and my telephones and my computers and my devices because I thought they had value. And if you remember right back at the beginning thing, it was solving problems for people that was the thing that got me going. And when I was working with, you know, a snack or something like that, I was going, I really don't get this. However, I found the branding problem of it absolutely fascinating. You know, how you take something that has a set of values and then how you communicate that through the brand. Again, I was not a graphic designer, but the way you talk about that brand, the way you create the values around it, the personality and so on, absolutely adored. But the product itself, I just felt really uncomfortable with. And I couldn't quite put my finger on it because there's some real classic things out there, you know, that have value to people, but I just didn't like it. And I realized back then it was really the fact that it was this single use, this plastic, this low value kind of world that I'd entered was the thing that I didn't like. You know, the fact that it was just selling this, you know, selling the same old thing that had been out there forever and ever and ever in the same way in an irresponsible, what I realized after the fact was in an irresponsible way, really. Not looking after the people that made it, you know, not looking after the afterlife of that product or the packaging in there. That circular thing, which I learned later, was the thing that I realized that what I really didn't like. And so when that twigged, then I thought, actually, I can feel really comfortable in this world because I can actually now solve a problem, a human problem, a planet problem here by working in that world and changing it. So coming to your end question, is there anything I would turn down? Absolutely not. Because I will work on anything where I can change that into a positive world. So I will work with cigarette companies or anybody if I can make something better. Better the planet, better for people. I will work on that. There's a massive job to be done. And excluding a company because I don't like them or, you know, or they, you know, whatever is not an option. We've got to get on with it.
You know, and I think, you know, you bring up something interesting there, Nick, which is the role that design plays either as leading consumers or as following consumers. And one of the analogies I would give would be plastic bags. And the US was far behind Europe in the evolution of, you know, plastic bags for, you know, supermarkets, right? But California was at the front end, where I live, was at the front end of banning plastic, single-use plastic bags for supermarkets. And it was fairly controversial, but also once people's habits changed, they really didn't care. And now when Californians travel to other parts of the US where there isn't, you know, there's no restriction, it feels weird, right? So as you look at, you know, sustainability and some of these issues, it probably goes against the practical notions that consumers have about convenience. You know, if I want to drink some water, it's easy for me to buy a plastic bottle and drink it and throw it in the trash. But that's, you know, that's why we have such a big problem, isn't it? So as a designer, and or even, you know, looking at someone who looks to make a difference in society, how do you grapple with what can be done today versus what should be done for the future?
A very interesting question to ask me right now, because that's something that we're absolutely grappling with. Because when we came into the world of sustainability, we thought, right, that's easy enough. What we do is we just go off and start designing circular systems for people. And as you said, it's not that easy. The first thing that comes along is that you've got to be doing the right system and in the right way. So if you take plastic bags, for example, in the UK, we now have more plastic in the system than we had before because we've moved away from single-use plastic. Because now people are buying thicker, heavier plastic bags. They're buying nearly as many of them, not quite as many, but in terms of volume of plastic, more. So it wasn't the right solution. But humans like to jump on something that they can understand, which seems really simple. Like getting rid of single-use plastic bags is a brilliant idea. Let's go and all jump on it. And so if I turn around and say, hang on a minute, guys, that's not actually the problem. The problem is actually not using virgin plastic, and so moving away from virgin plastic, but not using plastic made from arable land, etc., so that you're taking away from food. But the big thing is creating a circular system. Not single use is the problem, not plastic. Mm-hmm. And everyone's got really, so this is where Nick gets anal and gets into the detail. Where it's going, well, the first thing is we really need to understand what we need to do in terms of changing behavior to do the right thing. And of course, what happens and is that humans grab onto something new. And so changing behavior is actually not that difficult. Changing behavior into the right way is the difficult thing. So actually the single bag thing, like take, for example, you know, when they brought in the smoking ban in the UK, it was pretty adopted pretty universally. They didn't have to police it. There was no one being arrested for smoking cigarettes in a bar because culture had reached that point where we just went that we have to change, and they did it. Plastic bags was pretty good, you know, in a way that moved quite quickly along. As you said, the water bottle is a harder one because what's the alternative? There isn't one. There aren't taps everywhere and they're trying to do it, you know, and that would be a better solution. So first of all, it's understanding then if what is the right solution to do. And then what you're going is, how do we change consumer behavior to adopt that? So to give you an example, plastic bottles, which is a really big issue because everyone sees it. Everyone knows all the brands. It's all water brands like Danone and Nestle and Coca-Cola. Everyone's single-use plastic bottles is actually in some many countries where they don't have clean water. It's the best way of getting your water. It's pure. It's sterilized, it's clean, it's going to stay that way. It's the best way. But it's a single-use plastic. It doesn't have to be. So it can be made of recycled plastic, and you can recycle it. So actually, our job at the moment, working with people like Danone, is they're moving, you know, trying to move lock, stock, and barrel to recycled plastic. There isn't enough recycled plastic because not enough people recycle their plastic. So our job, right in the middle of here, and this is what I love as a kind of challenge, is if they move to a recycled plastic bottle, which costs 30% more at the moment because there isn't the volume, it's slightly off-coloured, so it's not appealing. In some cultures, like in Turkey, they see anything recycled as dirty, so it's culturally bad, and it's also it was illegal at one point. So how do we change their perception? But what we realise is if we can do that through communications at that point of purchase, if we can get them to understand this is actually made of recycled plastic, all of a sudden, the other bit's solved because they're going, oh, if that's made of recycled plastic, it means if I do recycle it, my bottle, it something happens to it. It doesn't just get burnt. Because they're all skeptical. They all just think, if I recycle this, it will just get put in the same thing. But as soon as you own a recycled bottle, you know that that's not true. So you kind of join it up. So those, for me, is what's absolutely fascinating about the role of design, is to join those two things up. Join the human stuff, the human psyche, the understanding of behaviors, with the product, the right product thing to do. And in fact, I think going forward, in a bit, in the way that with the product design mindset, it was like, how do we design this new, you know, durable pack that people will love? Yes, that's part of what we do in sustainability. But what we've realized is the bigger challenge is consumer behavior. And so we've created a thing called nudge design, which is a combination of cognitive psychology and understanding of behavioral economics with design thinking. And using design thinking to change behavior. And that's where I think that there's this amazing opportunity for us as a business, and for me very personally, to go in the future. We're working on some really interesting projects in that world. But yeah, so that went slightly off tangent.
No, fantastic. Nick, a question then related to that. You've got a huge passion here, sustainability, and clearly, you know, an insurmountable amount of knowledge. I guess two questions. One, for people listening who may or may not be in a marketing role or in some other role, a commercial role, or a maybe even not. How, you know, in the What I Wish I Knew piece and the reflection of that, how do people get to the kind of access point that you are now? Because it's such an important aspect of where we go in the future. So how would you say to people, hey, you know, just think about and the second question, and it's probably a bigger one, when you're with brand owners, you've got this massive energy here. How do you influence something and somebody that you don't necessarily have authority for?
You talked about passion. I think passion is the most important thing. Not knowledge, not hard work, nothing else. The passion is the important thing. People buy passion. Clients buy passion. They know that if you're passionate about doing something, you'll find the expertise you need to do it. You'll do the hard work. It's the first thing that comes, is the passion. And so if you go in there sort of, yeah, going through the numbers, as it were, you'll never get anywhere with a client. And I think that passion also brings people together who are like-minded. And coming back to Bill Moggridge, he had a huge passion for design. And he was right at the pivotal point of Silicon Valley and that whole world. He designed the first laptop. IDEO designed the first ever mouse, because he was fascinated by user interface design. And that passion just tumbled out, and people got attracted towards him because they shared the passion. And I found, actually, with us going off and doing our creds around what we're doing, is that you end up in meetings just having a really great conversation with someone, and you're no longer pitching to a client or would-be client. You're talking to a mate who shares the same passions. And you end up collaborating rather than working for them. That's my hope, anyway, and that certainly seems to be the way going forward. And it's often interesting when you go to a lot of these seminars and things, when they're talking about you need to find a point of difference, and then you won't ever have to compete for work. It's almost impossible to find a point of difference, I think. It's incredibly difficult, because, you know, my analogy is, if you're going into the pub to buy a pint of beer, you want a pint of beer. You don't want a pint of beer with, you know, tequila in it. You want a pint of beer. You know, you might sell a few beers with tequila, but not many. So being specialist in that sense doesn't really get you in there. You've got to be offering beer. But if you offer beer that's made in the most passionate way possible, then you'll win that customer over. because they'll know that you'll do it in the best way possible. It's infectious. So I'm glad that I found something I can be passionate about. And I suppose coming lesson learned, I think, for me, was at the beginning, I didn't know what I was passionate about. I knew there were things that I was good at and things that I would get involved in, but I didn't know how they came together. And I suppose this, my son and daughter are both just, you know, recently graduated with very good degrees. And it's been quite, I think, quite difficult for them to know where to go in their career, because they're highly qualified in what they do. One did maths and one did physics. So in non-specialist areas. So they could pretty much do anything they want to do going forward. And that's really scary, because there is so much of the world out there. And now, I mean, back in the day when we were young, it was very limited what you could even see you could do. You know, you probably asked your dad or one of your dad's mates what they did and followed that path. But now with the internet and everything else, the access, there's a gazillion jobs out there, which is almost more sort of debilitating than just following the path of what your dad did or what your uncle did. But my advice is, even if you don't know what you want to do, if there's an inkling, do it, try it. You have, there's no issue about zigzagging. You know, zigzagging at the beginning of your career, or even all through your entire career, as I've kind of done, is not a bad thing to do. And it's going to get you more like that going forward. I think the singular linear career has gone forever. Technology is moving so fast. Our jobs are changing faster than ever. But it does allow you to jump into jobs, try them out, and then zag somewhere else. Do what you did there, learn what you did there, and take that into another place and learn there, and find where you'll have to sit for a bit.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that, you know, Nick, you talk about, you know, finding the passion. And sometimes, you know, you see at, you know, university graduations, the notion, you know, a speaker will show up and say, you know, find your bliss, chase your passion, whatever. And it seems so nice, but also sort of lacking in the pragmatic aspect of the fact that the majority of kids that graduate do need to work and, you know, support themselves. But I think what you just described was this inherent curiosity about how things work and overlaid by a pragmatic approach of how could they be better. And it almost sounds like what you're saying is the advice to the younger crowd is to get started. And even if the early stages of career are almost an act of ruling out what you don't like, yeah, the idea is you're actually moving towards something, right?
Yeah, and I think also the intensity these days of education up to and through university is intense. I think it's and I think young people are absolutely focused. I mean, way more focused than I was. I mean, oh my God! I mean, I was, you know, I was just taking life in. I was enjoying life more than studying, I have to say. So when you come out at the end of that, it's like, oh my God! You know, you see the daylight and you see all those things. How on earth could anyone? I mean, there are people that just know exactly what they want to do, but they are in the minority, in my view. I think the vast majority of people really don't know what they want to do. They might have an inkling, they might have a notion of where they want to go. Jump, go and do it. If they don't know what to do, go and look. You know, go and try something. Go and do 2 weeks working, you know, in somewhere where you wouldn't even think you would be interested in, because you'll meet someone who knows someone who does something, who does something else. And you'll find a path. But unless you act, you don't really move forward. You've got to, you'll basically never know unless you act. So you've got to do stuff. And I suppose that requires a bit of faith, as well as pattern. So I don't necessarily think the passion comes first. I think that you've got to kind of just trust in the future, and it will happen, and you'll find your passion. I know a lot of people would say that, you know, I know people that have had very happy, long careers who are not passionate at all. They work to live. You know, their passions are outside their work. But I think that the old analogy is, if you love your job, you'll never work another day in your life. So I can't say that I can truly see that that's true for every day of my life. But, you know, it's an ambition, isn't it?
And just on that, Nick, you know, you talk about the zigzagging, you talk about take a jump, just to bring it towards the end of our discussions, how and what made you set up the Echo business? And just tell us a bit about the insights there.
That's interesting, because there were practical things there. The design industry is a young person's industry in the branding world, not necessarily in architecture or product design for that matter. This is underlying things as well, is actually being aware of what's happening out there is absolutely critical. What's the writing on the wall? I talked about my passion to move into branding. There was another factor in there, which was I could see the death knells of product design in the UK, because most manufacturers are moving out to the Far East. So being a product designer meant I did spend many of my years at IDEO going backwards and forwards to Taiwan developing stuff. And I thought, it's just going to get increasingly difficult to run a product design business in London. So I left IDEO, and very shortly after then, they lost an awful lot of their product designers because it just wasn't the work. So I was ahead of the curve on that. So that happened again when I was working as a head of innovation for various different sort of London-based agencies. I just thought the whole thing was so transient, and you're only good as your last job. And, you know, everyone around me was younger than me. And I just thought, unless I own my own business, I'm not going to be in work in a few years' time. So that was one thing that was on my mind. The second thing was that actually what I realized was this point, which is actually the founding story around Echo, is that I truly believe that brand and product are one. You can't separate them. And what I said before, in the product design world, they didn't see a connection to brand. And in the branding world, they didn't seem to care very much about the product in many cases. And it's often, there wasn't a lack of care in so much that, you know, their product had been around forever. So it wasn't ever part of the development of the story. It just is what it is. And marketing and branding was all about just representing it in a slightly different way. And I really felt that that was wrong. And there was an opportunity there to bring the two together, to actually think about brand and product as one. And that's why I formed the company, because I couldn't do that within any of the other agencies that I'm working for, because for them, brand was number one and product was very low down their list. They weren't interested in it. So that's why I formed the company. I found like-minded people to do that. And I think it's never been truer today, because, you know, we talked about sustainability. Sustainability requires both communication and design, product design, in order to achieve it. So that's the two things need working in unison. And also the digital world has made the product into a service, which is part of the communication. So now there's increasingly this combination of the two is coming together. So it took a while for that to really come on song, but in the early days it was a difficult sell. And a point I made earlier about where the company was starting to drift was we won more and more branding only work, graphics work, and I didn't want the business just to be a graphic design agency. I wanted it to be this whole, and the sustainability is starting to bring that back into the fold. So yeah.
Okay, well, Nick, thank you very much for attending the show, and we wish you all the best with that and the career of your associates beyond that too. So yeah. Thank you very much.
And thank you for inviting me. Enjoyed it.
Thank you.
We do hope you enjoyed this podcast, and thanks for listening to What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Dorr. Please join us at whatiwishiknewshow.com. You can subscribe to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Please share What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Dorr with your friends. We welcome your feedback and recommendations of new podcast guests and ideas on topics. If you have business challenges, we're also available for advisory and consulting roles. We'd be delighted to listen and help. Just send us an email. Our address is hello@whatiwishiknewshow.com.